This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with the author, Mark Clifford, the journalist, Mark Clifford. Today, Hong Kong, tomorrow, the world, what China's crackdown reveals about its plans to end freedom everywhere. Mark arrives in Hong Kong in 1992. At that point, everybody in China, I read, was still reacting to, thinking about, or unaware of something that horrible had happened in Beijing in 1989 that we now refer to as Tiananmen. What was Tiananmen to the people of Hong Kong when you arrived, Mark? Can you cast your youth and imagine what they were saying about it, what they thought about it every June when the anniversary came?
Well, they didn't wait until every June. Pretty much every day, they were conscious that in 5 years, they were going to be taken over by the Chinese Communist Party. And the slogan was, today's China is tomorrow's Hong Kong. That's what started, that appeared during the pro-democracy protests of 1989, not just in Beijing, but in dozens and scores of cities around China. And, you know, hundreds of people were killed outside of Beijing. And so Hong Kong was very aware that the brutality that they saw in China displayed by the leadership to kill some of the best and the brightest of the students in Beijing and others around the country, that brutality, that leadership was going to be taking over Hong Kong in 5 years. So there was a lot of fear. And I moved in June, mid-1992, June, and it was a couple months after the Supreme Leader, Deng Xiaoping, had made a famous southern tour, which was trying to he went to the south of China from Beijing. He was in his 90s then, and it wasn't, he was late 80s then. He was trying to revitalize economic reforms because Deng had started economic reforms after the disastrous Mao years, and they had gotten some purchase, gotten going, but it was still early days. And then the Tiananmen killings just stopped everything. And Deng was trying to restart the economy but keep politics under control. And so Hong Kong was very aware of that. Here was the most open economy in what was going to be, you know, it's going to be part of China, and yet a place that was also the most open politically. So everybody, every day, worried about 1997.
In 1982, Margaret Thatcher, then the Prime Minister of Britain, visited Hong Kong, and that was the moment when Britain decided, or was obliged to decide, that Hong Kong, in 15 years' time, would be passed over to the mainland's governance. Everybody's aware in 1982, that was the depths of the Cold War. That's when it was routine to imagine that the world is going to end again. Ronald Reagan was in the White House, and a series of brutes in Moscow led everyone, and one of whom was the head of the KGB, led everyone to believe worst possible scenarios. 1992, however, this period of early 1990s, there is reason to believe, to be positive, that things might work out, and we now need to speak of the personality and the success or not of the governor, Chris Patten. What do we need to know about Chris Patten and his role in this transformation, Mark?
I think he's a very important figure. He also came in mid-1992, coincidentally, a month after I did, was tasked with John Major, who had succeeded Margaret Thatcher, with trying to raise the bar for democracy and openness in Hong Kong. Major had been treated very badly on a visit to China. I think he always found the Chinese very unhelpful on Hong Kong, very suspicious, very grudging. And I think he just got fed up with it. It's sad that, you know, this hadn't happened 10 or 20 or, as I said, you know, 70 years earlier. But Chris Patten came when he came, and he immediately, first thing he did was the day after he arrived was to do a walkabout through a crowded market area of a very working class part of Hong Kong. He was a retail politician, and he'd got the political bug working for John Lindsay when Lindsay was running for mayor of New York. And Patten brought that complete breath of fresh air after the blimps and the colonial governors wearing hats with feathered plumes on them. Patten was like kind of ordinary guy who'd talk to people and eat egg tarts, a popular specialty in Hong Kong. But more than that, he tried to improve people's lives, a lot of spending on sewage treatment. When he arrived, 90% of the sewage was just dumped into the harbor. Patten said, this is outrageous. And he coupled this kind of infrastructure, social welfare happening with more democracy. He dramatically increased the electoral franchise. He still had the right to appoint some people to the city council. He appointed young women, pro-democracy people. Completely flummoxed the Chinese because they've been used to dealing with the mandarins, the get along, go along, panda huggers in Britain's foreign and colonial
The blimps, the Chinese communists were satisfied with the blimps. They sat together and enjoyed themselves.
They loved the blimps because they were men after their own heart, and Patton wasn't. They couldn't control him. They didn't have anything on him. He was a guy who was transparent, who believed in openness, who believed in democracy. And one other very important thing, he constantly told the Hong Kong people how great they were. He helped them understand how special Hong Kong was. He helped end the colonial cringe. And that was as important as all of his democratic reforms, all of his spending. He got Hong Kongers to believe in themselves.
The detail I want to emphasize, did he walk through Sham Shui Po, the working
class? Sham Shui Po, yeah, he did, yeah.
A detail here. Hong Kong is not, at this time, glistening towers. It has a large working class, that's to be generous, poor section. And the housing is totally inadequate. Mark has mentioned that hygiene is a mixed story. I don't believe the wonderful subway trains. My son visited Hong Kong and he was a young person. He was dazzled by it, Mark. This is in the 21st century. So what we have here is not one great big group of middle-class people reading the New York Times. We have all parts of the mainland represented, all speaking Cantonese, and there are very few tourists or people coming from the mainland at this time. Is that correct in the early 90s?
Absolutely correct. A couple thousand a year. It was 50 million by 2018. But at that point, you didn't hear Mandarin on the streets. It was, you know, a lot of six-story walk-ups. People lived in caged homes, subdivided flats. If you had some, I've been even recently, the last few years, could be 100, 125 square feet, and you'd have five people, a family of five in there. I mean, these were tough conditions. For a guy like Patton to come out, I mean, people mobbed him. I mean, they thrust babies at him. I mean, it's just unbelievable the adulation that people had for Patton and continued to have. I don't believe he can visit Hong Kong anymore. I don't think he'd be safe, but on recent visits, you know, I've been with him on some of them. The popular support for him is unbelievable. Anybody before or since like that? I mean, the guys that succeeded him, the Chinese chief executives, are afraid to walk out in the street.
Did he want to do a Singapore? Was that in the wind possible?
No. By that point, it was just too late. I mean, he was trying to make the best of a bad deal. I think if there were ever going to be a Singapore moment, it would have been in the late 40s, early 50s, when China was still weak. And it would have taken actually a lot more of a push from the U.S., I think, than it had. And by the way, Zhou Enlai, who was the premier, longtime number two to Mao Zedong, reached out with specific warnings to the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan in the mid-1950s, telling the British not to allow Hong Kong to go down.
Plot, conspiracy, 1958. Is there a word in Mandarin that everybody loves that means conspiracy, or do they have a lot of different characters? I mean, they seem to love this word.
Well, they don't believe that anything is true. They believe there has to be there has to be some kind of hidden plot. And they believe there was a hidden plot led by the Americans for dominion status. I never have seen any evidence of it. It doesn't mean it didn't exist. And by the way, Eisenhower did secretly pledge to defend Hong Kong, perhaps even using nuclear weapons if it were invaded by the Chinese. So, you know, look, the U.S. was very involved. But I've never seen any push towards independence.
John Major comes in the 97 handover. And the quote I have, and it's probably much longer, our former colony was in sparkling shape. What is this? He only sees the good parts of the world? What is he talking about?
It was, I think a lot of people, well, the Chinese thought that the British were deliberately going to sabotage the economy. They were going to take all the money and the reserves and everything good and trash the place. And in fact, economically, with the stock market, property prices, economic growth, low unemployment, Hong Kong was in great shape. It's not to say it didn't have a lot of problems, but as Major himself has written in his memoirs, he had to put a positive gloss on things. You know, as a prime minister, you can't say, actually, we're really worried that these thugs from up north are going to wreck things. I mean, that would be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So John Major was a little bit of a kind of Sonny John sort of personality when it came to this.
With the handover takes place, and now we come to the Asian contagion. There was a recession worldwide in 1998 that started in America, but spread quickly, and it damaged everybody's prospects. However, the war that starts in 2001 is a moment for Hong Kong to participate in the worldwide banking growth. And we have lots of money flowing into the mainland through Taiwan, through Hong Kong, through Singapore. And there's reason to believe that things are going to get better and better and better. And then when's the first bump in the 21st century? What date would you say foreshadowed where we are today, Mark?
Well, economically, I think, you know, a signal moment was with the global financial crisis in 2008. And China got out of that by printing money and came out of it really, really strong. But I'd also say you mentioned 2001 in the war, but it was also the 9/11 attacks. Just 3 months after the 9/11 attacks in December, China entered the World Trade Organization, which it had been trying to do for a decade or so. And many of us felt that this would put a lot of stress on China. And I, in fact, wrote a book with the incoming director general of the WTO. We were more optimistic, but we thought it was going to push reforms within China along. And it did push many reforms. In fact, it was so successful that China became an economic juggernaut of a sort that the world has never seen in terms of the speed of its growth and the growth of its export sector and its manufacturing sector. And so this combination of China entering the WTO in 2001, which really accelerated what was already rapid growth, combined with feebleness of the response in the West after the 2008 crisis, put China on a whole different trajectory and gave it a sense that it could do whatever it wanted in the world. And when Xi Jinping came in 10 years ago in 2012, he really pushed that agenda to establish China as the top dog, pushed that agenda along.
You were watching the Tibetan horrors in 2008, prior to and subsequent to the Olympics. The self-immolations, the brutality, the stationing of Chinese soldiers and fire companies throughout the large cities of Tibet. Did people in Hong Kong think that's our future, or was that another world?
No, it was another world. I think, and this is, you know, sort of the sad thing about Hong Kong having its own identity. It's always been felt that it was kind of apart from the mainland. So wasn't too worried about Tibet, wasn't too worried about the Uyghurs. In fact, Hong Kong became more insular. So this young generation of activists, this was more like 2014, but a lot of them stopped commemorating June 4th because they're like, democracy in China, what does that have to do with us? Mainland China, it's not our struggle. You know, we're about Hong Kong. And so sadly, and it's only now actually that you have this very large and growing Hong Kong diaspora that the Hong Kongers, the Uyghurs and the Tibetans and mainland activists are trying to act more in concert. Unfortunately, people are now outside of China.
Let's go to 2019 and the end. Mark Clifford, today Hong Kong, tomorrow the world. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.